Accession number 19922, Reel 1.
Barry Smith, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in a nursing home. I think it was St Mary's Nursing Home in Islington, North London.
Which year was this?
19th of December, 1932.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Islington area?
No. I was brought up in North London. Well, my family lived in North London, although they originated in Hertfordshire. My father had a business in North London, was in business in North London, and I grew up in that area. And my first recollections were of going to school at Raglan School, which is Bushill Park, North London.
What about the Second World War? Have you got any recollections of the war years?
Very much so. They have come back to me from time to time. It's funny what the brain is. I can recall the outbreak of the last war. The whole family... my father wasn't divorced in those days. My father and mother were divorced when I was about 10. We were all down at St Mary's Bay, which is in Kent. And I can remember the tanks, the Ben Gunn carriers coming in and the barbed wire going up on the front. And we all had to come home early. That's what I remember of the outbreak of the First World War.
Second World War.
The Second World War, yeah. I was, after that, I remember the various things of my childhood, but if it appertains to my war, recollections of the last war, it would be when I was evacuated with the rest of the school, and I was evacuated down to Diss in Norfolk. My mother was in business in North London, the grocery business, and my father was then in the police. So I was in North London. He was also in business, but he was in the special police constable, became full-time, as they did in those days.
Can you take me through the evacuation in detail? What happened to you, please?
Well, I was taken down by a very dear friend of my father's to Diss by car, and with another boy, we were put... we were, what do they call it in those days, you were sort of lodged with a family. He was the local policeman and also the local butcher. A very old cottage building. The room we were in, us two boys, I can't recall his name now, but I can certainly recall being with him. The room we were in was sort of damp and, you know, old cottage property. And we used to have to wash under the pump in the yard. We had to get the trick of this by getting it going just right, otherwise you flooded everything, including your trousers and shorts. And get it going just right, you had the soap. And we used to wash out there most time of the year, except the depth of the winter. Although as a butcher, we were made to eat everything. So if we had big pieces of fat, we had to eat that, whether you liked it or not. Either eat that or don't get anything else. And that's why I, to this day, don't like big pieces of fat. It's just something that's stuck in my claw ever since. That's one of the recollections. I can recall going to the local village school and helping out with the ploughing in the fields and collecting the apples. Incidentally, there was a film about this recently on the television about evacuees. I've never seen the exhibition at the Imperial War Museum about this, although I believe it happened recently. Yes, it was typical of childhood, I suppose, of evacuee of that time. We went to the local school and a very rural existence. We'd get on a horse and just ride it around the field, no saddle sort of thing. It was sort of we'd help out with the harvest, stacking the corn up and that sort of thing.
How did the London boys get on with the Norfolk boys?
I don't know. I don't. I think we were sort of considered to be foreigners, outsiders. I get that impression. And we went to local school, but I didn't suffer unduly from that because, as I say, I was had a friend with me and we used to go to local school. And I think my memory can't go back to any sort of any bad feelings about it. We just had to get on with it, and that's it. I felt very, very lonely in that sense. I was very sort of on my own. We grew up very quickly.
So was the evacuation a happy or unhappy experience for you?
Not happy, no. No, not what you call happy. Just did what you, in those days, you did what you were told and went about your business sort of thing, you know. And if someone said in authority that, well, today, children, you've got to go apple picking, that's what we did. You know, helping the farmers out and what have you, and just attended the local school, you know.
How did the host family treat you?
Strict, but not unkindly. Not unkindly, no. There's nothing unkind in that sense. Especially, I suppose, the lady. She was, if she's got to take two youngsters, on reflection, looking back on it, as you get older, you look back on these things, and things become a little bit clearer in a way. She had to have these two children, so you had to do what she said, and that was it. You know, you sort of do what you're told, and it's the best way, really. You wash under the pump in the yard, and you eat what I give you. You know.
Did your education suffer?
Yes. I went to, this is going to amaze you, but it's a fact. I went to something 13 schools. It so happened, I was brought back to London at the age of 10, thereabouts, North London, and I was brought back to London anyhow, and this was during the Blitz, and I remember that vividly, because my father was in the police during the Blitz, and I went to the local school in that area. I went to several local schools in the area because I was shoved around from one of the relatives to another. Eventually, as I say, the home that I remember in North London, in Southgate, I can remember the Blitz there. My schooling was very fragmented because I went from one school to another in North London. Goodness only knows why. That's because one relative lived in Barnet, another part, and I went to the school there, and then I was, the family pushed me around, as it were, you know. As I said, my mother and father divorced when I was 10. I remember sheltering in the, was it an Anderson shelter? We had like a large table, steel table, downstairs with a downstairs lady. And I can remember the planes coming over and the bombs dropping. And I was taken upstairs. He said, my father took me upstairs. He said, you must see this. He said, come upstairs. It's all right now because it's daylight. He took me upstairs to the bedroom I would have been in. And my curtains, the complete curtains from the window, were pinned on the other wall in entirety by shredded glass, as though someone had come along and put them there. The blast of the bombs and the landmines that had at that time just stuck them on the wall. And I remember the door was split down one side by a base of a shell, which I kept and no longer had. And I remember things vividly like that. But my school, as I say, was very fragmented, not at all happy. Subsequently, my grandfather, who was a master grocer, helped my father out financially, and I was sent away to a private school, which is Northall House in Northall. It's no longer there. Prep school. And very good at sports. And from there, I managed to get into a public school, purely on my, not my academic prowess, but the fact that I'd acquitted myself well. I wasn't scholastically brilliant, although as I got older and been in commercial life, I've become quite adept at things, to say the least. I was in banking for 16 years.
Which school was this that you went to?
I went to Camford School, Wimborne, Dorset. If you wanted to trace, my name would still be on the list, no doubt, but it would go back a long while. And I excelled at all sports, got my colours for cricket, tennis. My father was an ex-Wimbledon star-class tennis player, and I followed suit. It was natural. Sports, we're sports mad, in other words.
What was the address of this home in Southgate where the blast affected it?
It was a large maisonette flat we had in Selborne Road in Southgate. My mother was out working, and my father was out all hours God made with the police. Probably one of the factors that helped to shatter their marriage. And she was a master grocer. All that part of the family were master grocers. And she was running a shop in North London. And I, as a child, would go to school and be looked after by friends of hers and that sort of thing. I was sort of placed with a carer or another lady, a friend, what have you. And my education became fragmented, and I dropped behind 2 years, 3 years behind my normal education level. And that, as I was led to understand by my father, told me that they sent me away to a private school to help me pick up. I also had an inferior complex too at that time because of, I wasn't doing it so well. I could have done.
Do you have any other recollections of the bombing?
Yes, very much so. Not only what my father's told me, but at the end of our road, there was a bomb fell that contributed to the blast I was just previously referred to. And two or three houses completely flattened. And my father was one of the first police constables there, scrambling across the top to see if there's any survivors. And he listened, and he could hear a voice, and started chucking bricks all over the place and get to it. Eventually the ARP and these people came along and said, come on, we know all about it. My father said, well, there's a voice in there. So he started throwing these bricks out to get to it, and all of a sudden a hand comes out with a letter. It's quite serious. He said, would you mind posting this for me? And this is what my father said. It's remarkable. Also, they dug up the budgerigard, which was in a cage. The whole of the cage had been completely flattened, except for where the bird was. And he said, this is a miracle blast. He used to say that they used to come across the most weird effects of bomb blasts, in the last war. One of his colleagues went home from duty and found his front door in the back and the front door in the front, the back door in the front. It had switched the two doors, the blast had blown it straight through. He's also, it may have been the same person, one of the landmines or bombs dropped, and next to him, he remembers, was badly bruised, picked himself up, and he was in the next street. Now, this is a fact, and I don't doubt this, for my father used to, because the police used to invite his friends in to sit in our back kitchen, playing cards when they should have been elsewhere. Or they used to do some funny things in those days, as you probably know. And they used to know it was nothing unusual to have the chief inspector of police in there with a cup of tea on his rounds. They used to pop in the people, and things like that. But I can recall these things quite vividly, but not in entirety. They are things that come to you,
Were there any troops around, or POWs around in Southgate, or places where...
Not that I can recall. The only thing I can recall was the big Furze Lane battery, which is the anti-aircraft battery. Furze Lane, which is Winchmore Hill, by the swimming baths. They had a big field there. And they also had you could hear it going off. You could hear the it used to go off and then it would go off from another direction. And they had an artillery battery on the railway line as well. This was First Lane Battery. Now, this is well documented because it actually existed. In fact, there used to be army huts until quite recently down there, leftovers. But they had a anti-aircraft battery. It used to fly in over North London, you see, the bombers, and they'd catch them coming over North London and then down. You know.
Now, can you tell me how you came to be in the army yourself, please?
Yes, if you want my earliest recollections is that I was in the Army Cadet Force in Camford School, which I have the papers for here, and I did all the various qualification tests, and in actual fact I had Army training on quite a high level at quite an early age, part of the Cadet Force. And it must have been the Dorset Regiment, because at that time Wimborne was in Dorset. The Dorset or Dorsetshires, they would have been attached to the Dorset Regiment. I can show you the certificates, Rockman, here. And then, because my father couldn't keep me at school any longer because of the increased fees of the schools, you know, they cost a lot of money. I was an age then where I could say, have some opinions of my own. And I said, well, I'll leave school and I'll apply to go into the RAF. At that time, you could go from public school into the RAF. You could go there for a week and apply to become a pilot officer. And I thought, this was the thing. And they'd accept people straight from public schools. You've probably heard of this before. In those days, 1948-49, of that air time. I went to Hornchurch in Essex, and I was given a uniform, was there for a week. And not being scholastically brilliant, I couldn't pass the flying officer's exam. So they offered me ground staff, which I declined. I didn't want to be just a ground crew, although I might have done quite well in retrospect, I don't know. Then I went back to my original job, which was assistant estate agent negotiator with Hampton & Sons, the estate agents in Arlington Street, West End. It was that job I was offered when I came back out of the army. Well, that's neither here nor there. Then I received my normal National Service call-up papers. I was sent to an address, I think somewhere near Bloomsbury Square, I'm not too sure, and given the medical and all the usual things. And then in the post, in due course, I was told to report to the pay corps. You're going to find this unusual when I start telling you about it. I went did my basic training with the pay corps at Devizes in Wiltshire, and I think at that time the basic training was carried out by Army Corps, which was based up on Salisbury Plain. It was quite brutal, the training, as I remember rightly, because if you were doing exercises like crawling across a field, the sergeants would come along and say, do you want to get your behind shot off? If you don't, keep it down, and he put his boot on you in the mud, and it was quite brutal, really. And there's how you've been told all about when you first go there, you're given one pair of boots, one pair of trousers, sort of thing. It's all very confusing. Then you go through all the normal drilling and basic training, and then accomplishment with the rifles, etc., 303, firing, what have you, basic training. And then after that, they ask you, do you want to stay in this or go on? Do you have an interview with the officers? And I said, no, I don't want to stay in the pay corps, becoming a pay clerk. The reason I was put in the pay corps, no doubt, is in the army mind, because being in a clerical job before when in the army, they would naturally think I'd make a good clerk in the army. I don't think that was a good idea, but on the internet. Peculiar the way the army minds work. That's the way. So I asked for the service corps because I thought the idea at the time in national service was to get, if you've got a trade, you could use the trade in Civvy Street. I thought, well, at that time, someone said to me, transport is going to be the thing when you come out of the army. Lorries, transport, and that sort of thing is going to be the incoming thing, as you probably know it is now. So I applied for that, and lo and behold, he said, well, you've got your transfer, but I'm going to tell you, you're being put to the 1st Battalion Royal Fusiliers, and you report to the Tower of London. Got there, of course, went through another lot of training, and I was put on permanent staff at the Tower of London, and as such, I used to have a walking out pass, so I could, in fact, although I was on duty there on some occasions, I could also come home quite regularly. The reason I was put to the Tower of London may have been because of my City of London contacts, or to do with my uncle, what have you. I previously referred, he was in the Honourable Artillery Company. And it may have been that they said, well, did you have any relatives in the other military... You know, they do ask you things. Because my brain wouldn't... I can't remember now necessarily if they asked me that, but that seems to be the reasonable conclusion. I, with one or two other people there, got fed up with being just doing army duties at the Tower of London, and I did, in fact, go on a ceremony of the keys and all that sort of thing. And, of course, the regiment was stationed there as a full-time force then. So all the various parades and training was carried on there. But they said that the 1st Battalion, which was stationed at Iserlohn in West Germany at that time, part of the Rhine Army Brigade in the 50s, that's where it's all happening. And if you want to get a trade and move up, that's where you want to go. So I applied to go to the 1st Battalion, and was duly sent with a number of others, only a small squad really, about 10 of us, 20 of us, something like that, over by the Hook of Holland down to the regiment at Iserlohn. And then I was then part of the infantry regiment, then the 1st Battalion. I was well and truly integrated into the traditions of the 1st Battalion and trained as a rifleman in all armaments, Bren gun, Sten, Vickers, you name it, what we appeared, anti-tank missile, what have you. And then I was in D Company and I wanted to specialise, so my hearing, of course, I know it's damaged now, was then pretty good. And I applied to become part of Headquarter Company. And in so much as I got into that, I became a signaller. And I was trained past the Royal Signals exam, because the Royal Signals set exams for all the British regiments in those days, as a signaller, both in line and radio, etc., etc. And I got my cross flags and became a qualified infantry signaller, Headquarter Company. As such, when you go into action, you're seconded to a company where you will be with the officers in charge for communications on that company. And that's really basically what would happen in a wartime situation. We'll get to that in a minute, but that's as it was. The ambience of the battalion at that time was very high, very proud to be Fusiliers, City of London Regiment. And a great sort of ambience. Obviously, army life can be very boring, or it can be constant training, or etc., or cleaning, and all the various chores that goes with army life. That's all what have you. But when I became a signaller, things became more interesting. You were doing something then that was really, as you say, a bit more upmarket. Also, to use a common parlance, In so also we were given a higher grade. We were paid a little bit more. Well, it wasn't a lot more, but you were paid more money for being not a tradesman. There's a word for it. You were qualified signaller, like a qualified driver or qualified machine gunner, etc. You were given a grade.
A specialist.
You specialised, in other words, special. But it was known as a headquarter company, which then there'd be people that were in the intelligence section, etc. They would be infantry, but they were then specialised in the intelligence side. Maybe.
How did you get on with the Germans?
Very well. Of course, they did a lot of work in the camp. They were... they used to drive a lot of the lorries for general duties. And, of course, the black market was rife at that time. And I don't have to tell you this, but we were all involved in it.
What did that
amount to? Innocently or not. And I used to smoke quite heavily, but I used to get all my ration, and we used to send it through. I hope I don't get pilloried for this, but we used to send it through and out of the camp by the German drivers, and we used to get quite a lot more money for it than we could sell it for locally. And then they used to subsidise our money with that, and I used to buy presents like watches and DuPont ladies' nylons, which you could get over there, but you couldn't get in England, and send them home in the post. And in return, they would send me Nescafe. Now, Nescafe was loved by the Germans, so they didn't like Lion's coffee, but they liked Nescafe. And we used to give it to the drivers. We used to trip round the back of the barracks at night. This was the thing that they said, this is what you do. We picked this up from other fusiliers. You didn't do it off your own bat. It was, if you were caught, of course, it was court-martial, or certainly you'd be in a lot of trouble. But I think it was tolerated. I think they knew it went on. Within the confines of the camp, as long as they knew what was going on, like the custom exerciser knew what was going on, they knew it was a thing that existed, but as long as they had control over it, they knew, you know, they let it go on. And the coffee was run up under the seats of the trucks, up to, say, like Dortmund, where they could get more money for it. Then you were paid off at a later date.
Why should they get more money for it at Dortmund?
Because in the local towns they could get not as much money as they could if they ran it up to the big cities. And they'd also get a bigger cut, whoever was selling it, you know. Maybe. But Nescafe was... And I used to get large jars of Nescafe sent from my parents through the post. And they say, I've never drink so much coffee in all my life, they used to say. There you are. That I can. There's lots of things that I probably come to mind after this recording about those days, or what have you. But only, it was only part of my service. This wasn't the thing that occupied all of it.
But was there no conflict with the Germans?
No. I think the Germans tolerated us. They were invited, the German dignitaries and the German public, to the big two tattoos that we used to do. Trooping the colour, tattoos, searchlight tattoos, which we will put on in full best dress. We would do this, and the Germans would be invited to this, you know, so to see this, because Germans like to view military occasions, and this is all part of the PR, I suppose, in those days. When we went to leave down into the local town to go and have a beer in the local beer cellar and what have you, we were quietly tolerated. I think we were duty bound to be on reasonable behaviour. I don't think those of us that were, there were obviously one or two who got into trouble with girlfriends and the local police, and drinking too much, and what have you. This is endemic, or with most British regiments, I think you'll find, who are stationed abroad, maybe bald.